This is the Jewish News Podcast in association with Genesis Philanthropy Group, supporting Jewish communities worldwide. I'm Phil Dave, and coming up on this program this week, as Jewish teachers reveal that they have become targets of fanatical abuse in the classroom in the wake of the Israel-Hamas conflict, we look at exactly how schools in the UK have reacted to what is going on in the Middle East. We hear from those who know the pupils best, we hear from the teachers themselves, and we also explore just what can and should be done to tackle this rapidly growing problem. First things too, let's introduce you to the panel. We have Sharon Booth, who's founder and executive director of Solutions Not Sides. We have Rabbi David Meyer, executive director of PAGES, that's the Partnership for Jewish Schools. Johnny Newton is the head of government affairs at the CST. Debbie Penhay is education coordinator for Liberal Jewish Synagogue. And we also have a teacher who will remain anonymous for the duration of this podcast at a school in North London. Welcome to you all, and thank you very much indeed for joining us. Look, I suppose that where we should start is probably, I'd say, with you, Johnny, because last month we saw record numbers of anti-Semitism reported, and it's unfortunately been associated and linked with the situation that has gone on between Israel and Hamas. Maybe you'd be so kind as to give us an example of the sort of hatred that we are witnessing at the moment.
That's right. And unfortunately, the Jewish community has been in this position before. As night follows day, we know that when there is an escalation of conflict in the Middle East, there will be, or there is usually, an anti-Semitic backlash against Jewish communities around the world. Obviously, our focus is on the UK. And whenever I ask my instance departments to provide me with updated figures, the situation is so dynamic and so fluid that as soon as they do, those figures go out of date. So that's what everything has to be caveated with. We know that May will be the highest monthly total for anti-Semitism, for anti-Semitic figures that we have ever recorded. And we know that a significant proportion of those, unfortunately, have occurred at schools, around school children, and also on university campuses as well, which is different but linked. With regards to anti-Semitism and anti-Semitic incidents at schools, you know, it's about 20% of incidents that we've recorded over the last 3 or 4 weeks. The majority of the victims that have come to us are school children, but a significant minority were teachers. If you're looking for examples of incidents, just this morning when I was talking to a colleague of mine, she said that somebody, a teacher who is a Jewish teacher at a non-Jewish school, phoned her this morning and said and reported 10 separate anti-Semitic incidents that had happened to them over the previous couple of weeks, which really could be summarized as anti-Semitic bullying by school children, and is very difficult. People shouting at him, "Free Palestine," him walking into his classroom and "Free Palestine" being written on the whiteboard. Again, as people who know CST will know, that we don't categorize support for the Palestinian cause or for the Palestinian people per se as anti-Semitic, but when people are targeting Jewish people, specifically Jewish people, with this sort of rhetoric, then it is likely to be anti-Semitic. And if I just pull out one other incident, again, to show you about the sort of things that happened this time at school children. We received a report of a boy in year 12 who was walking home from school, a visibly Jewish young man, when somebody, a man driving past them, stuck up his middle finger. He was then immediately confronted by that man, who said, "Say you support Palestine or I'm going to punch you." He was fearful. He turned round and said that he supported Palestine. And as he was walking away, the individual that confronted him shouted and said, "Tell your effing mum and dad that they are murderers and killing babies." And for me, this encapsulates a lot of the reports that we're getting in of school children being targeted specifically because they're Jewish.
I think, Rabbi Meyer, what is particularly disturbing in all of this is that even just from that synopsis there of some of the incidents that Johnny and the others at the CST have had reported to them, is that the ignorance surrounding it is probably what's most frightening. That's, I think, what is that's really what stands out to me anyway, is that unfortunately sort of people are using this as an excuse to comment on a situation where they seemingly don't know very much about other than what they think they know.
Absolutely, Phil. I think it's actually it is a combination of ignorance and a feeling that people can use that ignorance as an excuse to manifest anti-Semitism. Because what is happening is that they do not understand the complexities of what is going on in the Middle East. Unfortunately, there is a lot of messaging that is taking place, especially over social media, which is just wildly inaccurate and is presenting. I mean, I have seen clips of videos of people saying the most horrific things that are patently untrue. And people are just going out on the streets and just saying these things. And impressionable young children are taking this as absolute gospel and believing that it is true. And on the back of that, they are then, and I think this is at least as worrying, they are transferring any negativity they have towards Israel immediately towards anybody who is Jewish and thinking, right, you are Jewish, therefore you need to be condemned for all the actions that Israel is taking. And both those aspects, you were seeing levels of racism, a level of discrimination against Israel, which is unwarranted and I think unreasoned, and then absolutely an abhorrent manifestation of anti-Semitism and anti-Semitic attacks against individuals as a result.
Debbie Penhey, you've been nodding along quite fiercely throughout a lot of the discussion we've heard so far. Tell us a little bit about your own experiences in the work that you do. What changes and what have you seen recently as a result of this latest conflict?
Well, it started when I had a phone call from a parent, one of our parents, whose six-year-old boy had come home from school and told his mother that they weren't allowed out to play at break time because the older children were protesting in the playground. This was the Free Palestine protest. And his mother went to the head teacher and asked why this was allowed. And she said, well, I thought it was, you know, they have a right to free speech. And then I asked some of our other parents if anybody else had any issues. And a father came forward and said he'd taken his six-year-old daughter to her theatre school. And while he waited there, inside the school, students were walking around with Free Palestine placards, taking them into classes. Apparently, another young girl told her dad that the new go-to insult for 11 to 15-year-olds at her secondary school is pro-Israeli. That's the insult. And there's a lot of reports from people coming back, little, not terribly frightening, but quite shocking and worrying about where it's going to go to. And I really feel that the answer is, it is because of ignorance, and the answer is to try and educate people, children in schools. So we turned to Sharon's group, Solutions Not Sides, for some excellent information for our children.
Well, we are definitely going to hear about some of that information from Sharon a little later on in this programme. But I think at this stage, what I'd quite like to do is, I mentioned at the start that also on this panel is that we have a teacher from a school in North London who, as I said, will remain anonymous throughout this programme. So for all intents and purposes, I shall be introducing them as teacher. So teacher, if I bring you in at this stage, would you be as so kind and so candid as to explain to us some of what you have witnessed and what you have been through?
Sure. Well, thank you for having me. I think it's important to note that I faced anti-Semitic abuse since I started, definitely not at the scale or the seriousness of what's currently happening now. But I think we do have to acknowledge and realize that there's an undercurrent here. Now, clearly the conflict kind of created this passionate resilience among the students is maybe how I would best describe it. And I think walking in the corridors, it was almost like a mob mentality. So students were quite emboldened, shouting Free Palestine at teachers. So I had that incident twice at me in the same day. Last year, again, bearing in mind there was no conflict. Well, there was, you know, there's this clearly tension in the Middle East. But last year, without any visible conflict, I had a student write Free Palestine on my whiteboard. I've had I Love Hitler written in some of my students' books. So 2 years ago, I found a swastika. So the list is unfortunately too long. And specifically with the conflict that occurred between Israel and Hamas the situation in the school was quite tense. So I guess it kind of peaked when I faced three incidences in the same day, and then unfortunately suffered an anxiety attack, one in the classroom. So when students shouted Free Palestine at me when they came to my classroom, and then the next day, unfortunately, this was after Shabbat, so Saturday night, some students started targeting me online, so calling names, saying they were ashamed to have me as a teacher at the school. One student said, well, she complained, why is my school filled with Zionists, was her post.
And this was sorry to interrupt you, but out of interest, what has the head teacher and what is the governing body of the school, again, obviously all remaining nameless, so no one here to defend themselves and all that, but what have they done about this? Have they just ignored it?
Great question. I think that's what I struggle the most with. So when students are behaving the way they're behaving, you can't excuse it, but you do expect adults to step up. And that's the issue that I have. Following the abuse that other teachers have also faced, so about, three other teachers faced similar abuse. The head teacher made an assembly on Monday. So the Friday was the peak of my incidences. Monday, there was a whole school assembly. It was quite stern. The message was very clear that this wouldn't be tolerated. And I didn't think the school were going to let this pass, right? You know, anyone would take any racist abuse seriously. I'm aware one student was internally excluded for a day and was spoken to by the police. And then another student was asked to stay home early, essentially. Other than that, I don't want to say that nothing else happened, but I'm not aware of anything else happening in terms of sanctions. And that's where we face ourselves. We had a meeting with the governor a week ago. They stated they had no idea this was happening, which was quite worrying, quite shocking. But I am hoping, I'm hoping that the school will continue to take the steps that they need to, to ensure this doesn't happen again. But at the moment, more needs to be done.
And Johnny, does this sound familiar to you? Because obviously teachers' story is just one example. You said that of the 20% of incidents that were reported, they came from school backgrounds, of the majority of them being pupils. But I'm assuming that a lot of this does sound quite familiar and what other teachers have potentially gone through as well.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, first of all, however much I hear from people who have gone through this, and I've been at CST for a very long time, it still never makes it any easier to hear it directly from the victim of something like this. And so, clearly deeper sympathies go towards teacher and anyone else that is going through this, and it's very difficult to hear. And as you say, we've heard this a lot. So a significant minority of teachers that are effectively being bullied. There are cases where, and it sounds like in teachers' case, that the school is making the right steps. And there are other cases where it seems like the schools are making right steps and being supportive of the teachers that are facing this. But there are also cases where that does not happen. And, it's an issue. And fundamentally, you feel that if this is going to continue and this ramps up, unfortunately, we know that this conflict is likely to flare up again, and this something like this could happen again. And if this wasn't to be sorted, then I imagine it could reach a stage where Jewish parents will be less inclined to send Jewish children to non-Jewish schools. Jewish teachers will be less inclined to teach at non-Jewish schools. And then you'll get what I imagine none of us wants, which is increasingly siloed communities where people actually aren't engaging and aren't talking in the way that we should in order to get our points across in a Western liberal democracy, and where the Jewish community is engaging less in multicultural society, which is absolutely somewhere that I imagine that the majority of the Jewish community just doesn't want to be.
Well, Rabbi Meyer, of course, we've heard recently the Education Secretary, Gavin Williamson, has said that he's written to head teachers asking them to be aware of the situation and to ensure that there is a balanced approach in terms of tackling this. Curiously enough, I believe that there was also one of the founders of the Al-Quds Day March, would you believe, where, of course, that sort of demonstrates some of the largest group of support for the creation of a Palestinian state that there is in this country, that's for sure, and also arguably the largest support against Israel, rather worryingly. But anyway, that's one side. Apparently, also one of the founders of the Al-Quds Day March has also written asking to make sure that head teachers are balanced as well, which seems quite extraordinary. But do you think, Rabbi Meir, that the government's response to this has been robust enough, or is there more to be done?
Well, to be fair, I think that the Secretary of State, his letter I thought was excellent, actually, and they brought it out very quickly. And I'd like to take this opportunity to thank my colleagues that I worked so closely with at the department for their efforts in producing that letter. The situation in reality in the schools is that you have got, unfortunately, some really radicalised students. To be fair, I think the vast majority are not necessarily radicalised, but see this as an opportunity to jump on the bandwagon. I think it's really important for us to appreciate that kids will be kids, and any opportunity to misbehave and run around screaming and shouting in a school, I mean, is a terrible act of behaviour, but can happen. I don't think or believe that every single one of them is a radicalised, and I don't think that necessarily they understand, certainly I'm sure they don't understand the full impact of what they're saying. But be that as it may, it's created a culture and an atmosphere within the school which is unacceptable. And more worrying in a way is that when head teachers have stood up to try and calm the situation and to ask that Free Palestine banners not be displayed around the school and such like, they have received such a torrent of abuse and such pushback from parents and the such like that they are scared to step up and try and reduce the level of intolerance. So the letter of the Secretary of State has certainly been helpful in that regard. I can share with you that I had a meeting today at a very high level with Ofsted, and I know that they have also expressed their concern about what is going on in the schools, and I suspect will come out with some comments around this as well. So I think that there is some important action that has been taken by the government. The problem, if I may say, is that we have got to change the culture within our society. Too often, people are standing by, and in many cases, we're the silent majority that are allowing a minority to be screaming out and creating an atmosphere which is unacceptable. And what really needs to happen is it can't just be the Secretary of State or the Prime Minister or the Mayor who is saying this is unacceptable. It needs to be every single teacher, every single balanced-minded student, and indeed all the parents who are turning around and saying, no, this is not the way that we want education to be taking place within our schools. And I think that if we can create a culture and an atmosphere, which is actually what British values is all about, is showing tolerance to people with different views, then I believe we can take a step forward in this regard.
But Debbie, it doesn't feel as though that we've got this tolerance towards different views, and it's felt like this on a number of different subjects for quite a long time. So with something as sensitive and hypersensitive as Israel and Hamas situation is concerned, is this almost to be expected in this day and age? Or how can we rest on our laurels about it? What should we be doing to try and address this sort of behaviour in this sort of situation?
Personally, as an educator, I'd like to take the education route and use people like Sharon's organisation and others to educate children in schools about what's actually happening, not just probably in Palestine and Israel. You know, there are conflicts all over the world and we hear about them and some people demonstrate about them, but nobody really says, well, let's learn about them. What are the facts? What's the history? And I think David is absolutely right that people are jumping on the bandwagon. Children have been heard to say, oh, I wanted to support my Muslim friends. That's why I wanted to join the Palestine protest. And they don't know why they're protesting. We are trying, I say we as in the Jewish organisations, certainly the Liberal Jewish Movement, the Reform Movement and others have been trying to put on sessions for Jewish children in the schools, helping them become more aware of what the facts are and how they can deal with these actions against them. But I feel like we're not doing enough. We need to educate like everybody, although that's probably a bit impossible. Somehow I feel we need the real facts to be out there so people can make decisions and not just jump on the bandwagon to protest.
Well, of course, what doesn't help is all of the misinformation that is just pouring out online, which sadly there seems to be no control over whatsoever. Teacher, from your perspective, I just wondered, What sort of reaction have you had if you try and re-educate your pupils? Because I assume, and forgive me if this is wrong, but I assume you haven't just graciously accepted the bile that appears to have been pouring from their mouths towards you. And have you tried to correct them and re-educate? And if so, what reaction have you garnered as a result of that?
Sure. So interestingly enough, when I first started, I was basically warned to not bring up Israel, to not really, like, you know, mention it. And I kind of took that on board until I realized that that clearly wasn't going to make a difference. That year or the year after, when I started working, I got married in Israel. And I think that's where I was able to maybe create some form of discussion with my form students, especially. And to be honest, they were absolutely fine. They were engaged. They were curious. They wanted to know more about the region, about the country. And I gladly kind of shared my own experience. I studied politics at uni, so I think I was quite confident in doing that where the time was right. But, you know, first and foremost, I'm a teacher that isn't qualified to then teach students about such issues. So I didn't want to kind of make it where I was the one that they should go to, you know, to get this sort of information. So the school did bring in certain organizations. We had Solutions Not Sides come in. We've had, you know, I've done a Holocaust Memorial Assembly, a Hanukkah Assembly, and it all was okay. But I think what I've come to realize is that none of that matters unless you change the culture and the mentality of certain students. So we've mentioned social media, and I've seen, like, horrendous videos on TikTok, especially where students are kind of, you know, again, jumping on the bandwagon. A lot of parents were complaining that stemming free speech was dangerous. And so there's clearly some form of miscommunication here. So education is great. You know, it's not something that we shouldn't encourage. I think that's really excellent. However, we also do need appropriate sanctions for this sort of behavior. And I think that's what we're missing, in my opinion.
I agree in the sense that a lot of schools, I think, are banning Free Palestine protests, but not explaining why. They're just banning them. There's reports of teachers ripping up posters in front of pupils, and then, of course, that gets filmed and put on social media. But no, they're not actually explaining why. They're just saying you can't do this. And I think teacher is right. There's more education, much more education needs to be with the head teachers and the teachers themselves. I was appalled that she was told not to mention Israel when she was employed. Would they have told a teacher not to mention Palestine?
No, I think the answer is no. And it was definitely something out of fear. I didn't want to be known as, you know, a Jewish teacher. I just wanted to, you know, teach my subject that I love. But I think that's naturally what happens when students meet anyone really from an ethnicity that is a minority, you know, whether you're Jewish or really any other religious or cultural minority, they're going to react, right? They're either going to be curious or considerate or sometimes the opposite. And I think we really need to think about how we educate them at the same time, create, you know, a rewards and sanctions policy that kind of goes alongside that.
Well, at this stage, there's a couple of times that social media has been brought into this discussion. And Johnny, I wonder if we take it back to you and say, how much of the onus do you believe lies on social media companies for fueling this particular situation? Because there's a very strong argument, I would have thought, to be had that if such malicious tripe wasn't flying around social media, then who knows what the pupils might actually know about this, because they'd probably only see what they know from the news, and arguably what's in the news is not quite as foul as what's online.
Yeah, I would say a significant amount. I think this is the first escalation of this type and conflict of this type that we have seen. The impact of TikTok and Instagram and Snapchat, which are specifically directed at young people, come into play. Obviously, the last significant escalation of the conflict was in 2014, and it was in the summer of 2014, where notably schools were out for the summer and universities were out for the summer, and social media was a different place. Anything that's anti-Semitic, that breaks the law, that breaks community standards, should be taken down anyway. We've got significant reach with social media companies to try and make that happen and to report and to escalate. We've got trusted status with a whole load of those organizations. But obviously the amount of anti-Semitism across all social media companies is too much. And I think that when we're talking about the impact of social media, it's also important to talk about the potential impact of the impending online safety bill that is about to hit pre-legislative scrutiny. It was mentioned in the Queen's speech, and we expect to see that being debated and passed in the coming months, if not before the end of the year. And hopefully that will bring social media companies to heel slightly. There will be a regulator, there will be fining powers. Some elements of what we would like to see are missing, but we're hoping that it will have some sort of an impact. But when you're talking about the conflict and views on Israel-Palestine, some of the stuff that, or a lot of the stuff that's on there, won't cross community standards. It could certainly be a gross simplification of a very complex historical situation, which then puts people on the side of the oppressed, in inverted commas, and oppressor, in inverted commas, and therefore puts people on the side of good and evil, again, both caveats with commas. And it makes it very easy for people then to target Jewish students and Jewish teachers. So although social media drives this sort of stuff, the incidents that we've seen, actually the majority of them happen offline. And it's what people do once they come off the social media, where they go and target other Jewish school children or Jewish teachers or what it may be. But in short answer to your question, yes, I think a significant responsibility for what is driving this spike in anti-Semitism is what's occurring on social media.
Well, Rabbi Meyer, I mean, I suppose the problem is as well that for as long as social media is unregulated in the way that it is, and that there is pretty much no control over what goes out on there apart from the social media companies themselves, parents will probably understandably be quite fearful for their children, being a pupil in particular, I would have thought, at more non-Jewish schools. With that in mind, have you been in contact with any parents whose children are, say, from non-Jewish schools? And what advice would you give them if that is the case, if they are that fearful?
Yeah, I mean, unfortunately, I was in touch with a parent who has now decided to take her child out of the school and actually to transfer her to a Jewish school because of the abuse that her child has been facing. I think that social media is an enormous problem. And to be honest with you, it spans far beyond just the issue around anti-Semitism. Unfortunately, I don't think that most parents are aware of the level of information that is being exchanged and inaccuracy of the information is being exchanged over social media. And to be frank with you, I don't think that most parents know how to deal with that at all. Interestingly enough, I was speaking to a group of slightly older teenagers and asking them, what would be the thing you would do differently when you became a parent? And almost all of them said that they would limit the amount of access that their children would have on social media. When I suggested to them that maybe their parents would be doing the same, they were quite shocked because they obviously see both sides of that coin. But it is a very difficult thing. And I think that for anybody as a parent, and I include myself in this, it is really difficult to find the balance between trying to trust our children, give them access to social media, which is really the method of communicating, especially during this pandemic, between friends, and the fact that unfortunately it is a totally unmonitored environment that has access to influences that we would never, ever want our children to be meeting.
Now, I've been teasing throughout this podcast that Sharon Booth is also with us as well. She's founder and executive director of Solutions Not Sides. And there is a reason why that we have held you off for as long as we have, Sharon. And that's because the work that your organization does, in my humble, is so important. I know that everyone's playing a massive part in trying to tackle this. There's not one person who's on this podcast that them and their organizations aren't playing an important part in all of this particular debacle. But in particular with you, you seem to offer, and your organization offers, an alternative perspective that actually could help people find more common ground rather than picking sides. And that is what is so essential in trying to combat all of this hoo-ha. So with that in mind, Sharon, please do tell us a little bit about, first and foremost, what Solutions Not Sides actually does do.
Thanks, Phil. So yeah, obviously, as has been mentioned already, education and critical thinking on this topic is key. And we exist to address anti-Semitism and Islamophobia when it arises around this topic in schools. So a great many teachers that I've had conversations with in the past couple of weeks, they've made a huge effort actually to understand the subject in more depth and provide the opportunity of a safe space, freedom of expression and learning and so on for their students. Some, unfortunately, have opted, as has been mentioned, to keep the topic out of school, perhaps unsure of how to deal with it or anxious that they might do more harm than good. And while we fully appreciate the pressures on teachers, here at Solutions Not Sides, we believe that avoiding talking about politics leads to a lack of understanding of it, and that instead young people should be equipped to have a civil conversation about a difficult topic. So I think students should have the opportunity to express their concerns for Palestinian human rights within a framework where hatred towards people of different backgrounds and opinions to themselves is avoided. So we definitely encourage teachers to designate some time in the school schedule for students to raise political issues of all kinds that they feel strongly about, but to use the three E's that lie at the heart of our education programme. So one is exploration. And this involves looking at diverse news and media outlets on this topic and speaking to people who take opposing positions in order to understand why they hold those positions. And the purpose of this should not be to reconcile or justify anything, but to gain the necessary information that will help with a critical thinking process to decide what action is likely to be the most effective in changing the situation for the better. The second E is empathy. This comes from humanisation of people from the civil society in Israel and Palestine, and also of each other as British people with the different opinions that we hold on this. So this can be done by personal stories in literature and film, or through the opportunity to actually meet and talk to people in Israel, Palestine, such as we provide in our programme. And the third E is empowerment. So that's providing both the space and the skills for young people to take action towards a just and peaceful solution for Palestinians and Israelis, driven by certain values. So those values would be equality, non-violence, and the rejection of hatred.
Which all sounds absolutely fantastic, frankly, because it's a different way of addressing and thinking. And, well, I say an age-old argument, let's be honest. It's been an argument for as long as Israel was reborn in the 1940s. But at the same time, it certainly feels like it's one that's been around for most of our lifetimes. And I suppose, teacher, if I could turn to you at this stage, where I say that you actually mentioned about the involvement of Solutions Not Sides. And I'm just wondering what sort of reaction pupils gave towards this sort of alternative way of thinking, because clearly most recently it doesn't seem to have done anything to help you.
Sure. So I really can only speak on behalf of the classroom I was in, not the whole year group. And their reaction, actually, funny enough, was silence, really. A few kids were asking questions. I don't know if it's safe to assume, but maybe it is, that me being Jewish in the classroom maybe got some students to maybe be hesitant and not share some of the questions they might have had. But I think most students, just from what I felt leading up to the session, so before we had Solutions Outside come in, we had two prep sessions where we watched a video, we filled in a few questions in this booklet. A lot of the girls had no idea about anything, really, as you would expect. I think we speak about the conflict often in our circles, but when you take it to the wider public, many are not informed. So explaining to them what Zionism is and what Israel is and what Palestine is was all fine. There were no issues. The students just were really out of their depth, I think is quite accurate to say. The actual Solutions Not Sides sessions was good. We had two speakers, an Israeli and a Palestinian. Again, most of the girls were quiet. They were listening. A few had questions. The only issue that came up really was this statement on apartheid. So one of the speakers, I can't remember if it was the Israeli or the Palestinian, kind of mentioned that Israel is similar to an apartheid state. And I really found issue with that. But again, you know, the session ended. The day went on as normal. Nothing happened. But again, you know, a few months down the line, another anti-Semitic incident crops up and we kind of go back full circle.
I mean, and if I could just come back in at this point to talk a little bit more about that particular session that we were in. So first of all, it was really great to be able to come and visit your school. Thank you for that invitation. One of the things that we feel that's really important as well in our sessions when we have, you know, the ample time to address things is what these words mean, like words like apartheid, for example, that we get back to definitions and etymology on these things, see where they originally came from, and apply critical thinking. So the third part of the session, which I know we didn't get to do in your school, and actually I would love to come back and do, is the critical thinking section, where students hear about the needs of both Palestinians and Israelis, what they need for the future, for a better life. And they get to apply this critical thinking tool of an iceberg to understand what those needs are. If it's useful for people, I can just share about that here, because it's a tool that I think teachers can use in schools without us. I mean, they can actually use this tool. If you take an iceberg, the tip of it represents the positions that people hold, usually quite simplistic, so maybe good guys versus bad guys, etc. But the large part of the iceberg that you can't see unless you dive down and look represents all the reasons why people hold those positions. So it could be wounds, needs, perceptions, a whole host of other things. So, for example, if you have students that are entrenched in a cycle of free Palestine versus save Israel, encourage them to understand why each of them holds those positions, what fears or needs they have, and why the issue is important to them. And I've seen so many of our Palestinian and Israeli speakers in our program address this by modeling breaking that cycle. They both simultaneously recognize that Israelis must be safe and Palestinians must be free. And once we start to move towards that conversation, then we can begin having these constructive conversations around what I call win-win. So rather than pushing for a win-lose outcome, taking sides, we need to be looking at what a win-win outcome and having that conversation with each other, what that win-win outcome might look like by listening to Israelis and Palestinians. Definitely, we need to improve in some of our delivery, especially under COVID conditions. And if there's anything further we can do to help your school, then please do let us know.
And this is, of course, is the issue, isn't it? Is that sort of unfortunately, sort of you can have these fantastic initiatives such as Sharon and her team at Solutions Not Sides. But of course, it's getting that message to stick. And Rabbi Meyer, I just wonder whether or not sort of from your perspective, sort of do Jewish schools look on with a sense of, how can I put this? Not a sense of smugness, because obviously, you know, I dare say I know actually some Jewish people who are really conflicted about the situation in the Middle East. But do you look on with a sense of almost, well, this is how we do it, so why is it so difficult for mainstream schools to follow suit? Do you see what I mean?
I do. To be honest with you, I think it's actually been a really difficult area for schools in our community to teach. Because even within the Jewish community, there is a vast disparity of views. And in fact, I think that there have been some schools that have been quite uneasy about how they would approach the subject. As a result of that, over the past couple of years, we have been working on a JTRACS curriculum, which looks at the teaching of Jewish history and then Israel education, and it explores within that different narratives so that the students understand that there are different perspectives. In fact, I would say, I think it would be quite dangerous for a child to graduate from our schools without an understanding and an appreciation of the different perspectives and different attitudes. Of course, they've got a right to have their own understandings and beliefs. But unless they can appreciate the difficulties and challenges and rights and wrongs on both sides, they're really not going to be able to have a meaningful discussion when they graduate. And I think will eventually suffer as a result of that.
Sharon, if I could ask, so from your perspective, how widespread do you believe this problem to be, though, in terms of the notion of misinformation in mainstream schools and the way that pupils are going around and just really using it as an excuse to, let's be honest, to just Jew bash? I don't really know what else to describe it as, really.
So we've published a guide on our website. It's 10 points to avoid Islamophobia and anti-Semitism when you're talking about these issues. I think that one of the reasons that people feel so strongly about this is obviously faith affiliation. So we've worked with Jewish, Christian and Muslim communities who all, because this is the Holy Land, from their faith narratives, have very strong emotions around this. And that's something that obviously needs to be recognised. But at the same time, it's not just those communities that get active on this. It's also, we've worked with many students who come from refugee backgrounds of all kinds, by the way, who feel some kind of shared experience with people involved in this issue. So they may get quite heavily involved. Also, students who come from more political families, maybe, so that could be far left, it could be far right, they may also get involved in this discussion. So it is widespread across many different levels. And I think because it's such an emotive issue, it can sometimes get used for a kind of a symbol of standing for something else. We've seen it with Northern Ireland as well. So Protestant and Catholic students or students who are actually from Northern Ireland or Ireland sometimes use this. We've seen the Northern Irish side waving the Israeli flag and the Catholic Irish side waving the Palestinian flag. The more we simplify this issue into being about something else that people care about, the more we confuse things. And I think it's really important we bring it back to actually critical thinking and listening to the people of Israel and Palestine.
Well, for what my two pennies worth is worth, I mean, whenever I try and explain it to non-Jewish friends and colleagues who perhaps don't have an interest in what goes on other than what they're just hearing in the news and the rather inflammatory pictures, more importantly, that they keep seeing in the news and the mainstream media, is I try and explain it that it is not a glorified football match. This is not about picking sides. This is about choosing life and trying to see what can be done to save as many people in that region as possible, whatever side of the political fence you sit on. As soon as you even say those few words, it's amazing the reaction you get, because they think, hang on, so you mean I don't have to choose a side? It's even as something as basic as that, that they don't know. But there was something that was quite interesting that you mentioned just now, Sharon, that I wonder whether or not, Johnny, if we come back to you on. And that was that Sharon was talking about religious affiliation. And based on the information that CST has been gathering in recent times, also picking up on something else that was said earlier on, which is that pupils are going out of their way to support their Muslim friends, but they don't necessarily know why they're doing that. I just wonder whether or not does CST have any information as to how many of these incidents are specifically, shall we say, from Muslim students who are passionate about the cause versus those who are just the sheep, as it were, who were just following on for the heck of it?
I don't have data about the incidents that occurred in schools, but we did analyse last week a bit of data about the wider incidents. So, you know, the larger figure that I was talking about beforehand, outside of schools and including schools, we always ask victims whether they can describe perpetrators to us. In normal times, the vast majority of perpetrators are described as white. And we use police identification codes as well, because, you know, based on what somebody looks like, you can't necessarily get a sense of their religion, for example. And the trend that occurs during these spikes and has done previously and has repeated itself this time is that those figures are reversed. So the majority of incidents that come in that are linked to the Israel-Palestine conflict, sadly, come from people where we know who the perpetrators are and where they've been described, are people that are described as Arab or North African or South Asian. And you can lead from that it is likely that the majority of those people are adherents of the Muslim faith, but not necessarily. So it certainly is something that exercises the Muslim community in a way that they aren't exercised, or the Muslim community is not exercised in the same way at times when Israel is not at conflict.
And may I just say, of course, you know, that we make it very clear, it doesn't matter what side or background someone comes from, one way or another, if they are party to an anti-Semitic incident of any description, you know, wherever they come from, whatever their background, I mean, they're equally as abhorrent. It was more out of curiosity, and I hope that you don't mind me exploring that curiosity. If I may come back to you, Sharon, just to start sort of trying to draw some sort of conclusion, what sort of advice would you and your organisation give to someone listening to this right now in a means of actually trying to move this forward and trying to help people begin to start realizing that there has to be some sort of answer to all of this, and frankly batting backwards and forwards, saying that you're wrong, we're right, vice versa, is not the way. So what advice would you give?
We don't want to depoliticize students. We definitely want to give them a constructive way to be political around this that is going to help the people of the region, all Israelis and Palestinians involved in this. So we have a framework for activism, which we suggest questions that people can ask before they get involved in anything to try and ascertain whether it's going to be beneficial. So the three questions that we encourage students to ask are: one, is it fair to the people affected by this situation, both in the region and more widely? So that's number one, is it fair? Number two, is it constructive? I.e., will it actually work to improve the situation? Or is it just stoking one side against the other, for example? And three, is its goal a win-win outcome for Israel and Palestine? Is its goal a win-win outcome? If they're satisfied that the answer to those three questions is yes, and if it's within that framework of values that I talked about, non-violence, equality, and the rejection of hatred, then it's almost certainly a good activity for them to get involved in. So again, let's give students the benefit of our confidence in their ability to apply moral values and critical thinking.
And just finally, I'd say the final word should go to you, teacher, if that is okay. From your perspective, what needs to change to make your place of work a better place to be once more?
Great question. I think there needs to be more work around, you mentioned critical thinking quite a bit, so integrating that into the curriculum. Maybe that should be coming from Ofsted with more of like a deep dive. So when they visit schools and they carry out inspections, assessing the school's level of critical thinking in their curriculum would be at a great start. Bringing in organizations like Solutions Outside, maybe having that more consistently. So I've heard of many schools bringing in organizations as a reactionary approach to incidences that are happening, but I think we need to reverse that. So bringing in organizations like Solutions Outside, Stand Up, whatever it may be, right from September, right from the academic year, bringing them in maybe more consistently would be helpful. And more work needs to be done around how we view Jewish people as a minority. Because initially, when incidences were cropping up, a lot of Jewish teachers felt gaslighted. They were told that what they were experiencing wasn't racism or wasn't anti-Semitism. And educating teachers, maybe more importantly, so training them on how to deal with this in that scenario would be incredibly beneficial.
And might I be so bold as to suggest not telling teachers not to even mention Israel might be a good start as well.
I think that'd be a healthy way forward.
I need to say thank you to all of you for appearing on this podcast, because we are sadly out of time. But my very grateful thanks to Sharon Booth, founder and executive director of Solutions Not Sides, Rabbi David Meyer, Executive Director of Pages, Johnny Newton, Head of Government Affairs at CST, Debbie Penhay, Education Coordinator for Liberal Jewish Synagogue, and of course, a teacher from a school in North London. Thank you all very much indeed. And thank you, of course, for listening as well to this edition of the Jewish News Podcast in association with Genesis Philanthropy Group. Through its partners, GPG is working to support the growth of Jewish community life in the UK and worldwide. And for more information, you can always visit gpg.org. I also have to say thank you to our producer, Justin Cohen, for all of his work surrounding this particular episode. Please do subscribe to the show in your podcast application. That way you will hear any previous episode or be informed when new episodes become available. And don't forget that for any more of the information on the Israeli-Palestinian conflict that we have been talking about, you can always go to jewishnews.co.uk. And if you would like to comment, well, then we would love to hear from you as well. Please feel free to email editorial@thejngroup.com. That's editorial@thejngroup.com. From me, Phil Dave, do join us next time here on the Jewish News Podcast. Goodbye.